Well, today we come to week five of a five-week exploration of what some call emergent Christianity. And it's been an interesting journey. In a lot of ways, we come full circle back to where we began. If you recall, we began with that phrase, spiritual but not religious. And it's a phrase that I've heard a lot. I've ragged on it a lot, actually. I've had a rant now and then about people who claim to be spiritual but not religious. But I come to it with openness and hopefully an open mind to be changed, to be shaped by that, the questions that at least 30 million people who have left church in the last couple of decades are raising for us anew. And so today, and then we had in between, we had belonging, behaving, and believing as sort of those sort of benchmarks of emergence Christianity and some of the questions and the things, issues that were raised by those. And today we come to the very exciting title, Form and Function. Yeah, I'm being sarcastic. It's kind of dull to sound put it that way. But the sermon title, I think, rephrases it in a way that might be a little more interesting. And that is, and this is a very particular thing that we can actually look at here at Covenant Christian Church, and that is the difference between discipleship and membership. The difference between discipleship and membership. And that is one way for me to frame the conversation about form and function and how the church has sort of walked this path. And I think, you know, once upon a time, we knew discipleship. These folks who gathered in Jerusalem, in the temple and in their homes, broke bread, devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, to fellowship, to the prayers, that they knew what discipleship was about. But if you keep doing things in community with other people long enough, then you start to get a standardized form of doing things. We call it the status quo. And somewhere along the line, discipleship became membership. And, you know, the question was, are you a member? Are you a member? Yeah. Are you a member? No. Are you a disciple? Yeah, I think I would say you are too. So we started to draw these lines, and you were in if you were a member, and sorry, Joel, you're out if you're not a member. And somehow we missed the point, that this is the point, that discipleship is the point. And so here at Covenant, we've actually revise the bylaws, and this may be the one point that a lot of people have, well, there are a lot of things that people have questions about, but how does this actually work? I was talking with a certain person this week who will remain unnamed, but she's a musician here at church, and she gets paid to be here every Sunday. Yeah. And she made an interesting comment. She said, and I love putting her on the spot, we were talking about some of the stuff that I've been saying in recent weeks, and she just said, you know, am I the only non-member here? And I was like, well, we've redefined membership, so no. You're not even a non-member. You're one of us. If you show up on Sunday morning, you're one of us. If you can't show up on Sunday morning, but you participate in the life of church by even just sharing the newsletter or by sending in a donation or by being on the phone tree or the prayer chain. So we've changed the parameters of membership from whatever it was before, which I think there was a list of things. You stand up and you make your profession of faith, and you make a financial contribution, and you attend worship so many times a year, to really participation. That membership is really about discipleship. So we've actually tried to drop the word membership altogether. Because the point here is not to be a member of Covenant Christian Church. The point is to be a disciple of Christ. And there's even room to widen that a little bit. You know, maybe Joel identifies himself as a disciple, but maybe he doesn't. Maybe he's more of a seeker. And I know that Judith probably would define herself as more of a seeker than anything. Or am I putting words? Would you like to speak for yourself? Okay. But I hope you know that you don't have to keep your mouth shut, that here you do have a voice. Everyone here has a voice, and that's really what I'm talking about when it comes to to discipleship versus membership. I think it's really interesting that we have a snapshot of what early Christianity looked like in two verses in that Acts passage. And it's on this bookmark. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of bread and prayers. I'd like to talk about some of the ways, and again, I've been reading a lot and perusing a lot of just sort of where is this emergence Christianity happening in the world, and it's just very interesting to me. First of all, an important point I think that comes out of that idea of form and function is that we use the word emergence Christianity rather than emergent church. Anybody want to take a guess as to why we use that language? I'm looking at Brad because I know he's probably, and I know that Tom and Linda are reading the book by Diana Butler Bass, Christianity After Religion. See, the word church probably has shrunk who we really are, just like the word membership shrank what discipleship really could be about. And I think emergence Christianity is an attempt to open it up rather than close it down. And if you talk to the 30 million people who have left church and have no interest in church, it's because church has become a bad word, because it represents judgmentalism, narrow-mindedness, small-mindedness. You know, everybody has a story about being mistreated by a church at one point or not in their history, unfortunately. I'll bet that's true of people here. A lot of people here are recovering from being treated badly at church. And so, you know, in an effort to open that up and try to think bigger about what this community of faith means, they talk about emergence Christianity instead of emergent church. Although, you know, some people will say, I go to an emergent church. It's just still part of the language. But as we think about that Acts passage, I just want to kind of briefly hit several things that are sort of descriptive about emergence Christianity, kind of out of this conversation of form and function. It's what I would call reclaiming ancient practices. Okay, and if you read that verse in Acts about devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching, to the prayers, to the fellowship, to the breaking of bread, it goes on, the second verse is actually two verses. It's like there's one, it's almost like there's a title sentence and then there's a paragraph that expands it. And it goes on to say that when they gathered at the temple and in their homes, they broke bread with glad and generous hearts. They had all things in common. They sold their stuff and gave to the poor. I mean, we're talking behavior here, people. We're not just talking belief. We're talking putting your money where your mouth is, literally. And it was a way of life. It was a vision of kingdom sort of ethics to fulfill the ministry of Jesus. So there's a sense in which emergence Christianity attempts to reclaim a lot of these ancient ways and ancient practices. The word practice is important, okay? So it used to be that orthodoxy was real important. And orthodoxy means right belief. And there's a new word called orthopraxis, which means right action or right practice. And just in a sort of, I'm painting with broad strokes here, some things that I think describe emergence Christianity and that reclaiming of these ancient ways. And one is to both, and we talked about this in Sunday school this morning, the marrying of head and heart. Phyllis Tickle says the Reformation was a move north. And by that she means it moved Christianity from a place of a faith of the heart to a religion of the head. And so emergence Christianity tries to make that journey, not just the journey back to the heart. You can take your head with you. You don't have to check your brain at the door. We say that around here a lot. And that's a great thing about emergence Christianity is that we don't have to check our brain at the door and decide in a debate between Bill Nye, the science guy, and Ken Ham of the Creation Museum. I just shake my head. I just like, anyway. But to marry the head and the heart, to bring both into an integrated, faithful experience of authenticity. is really what worship in Emergence Church looks like. So maybe we do things around here that try to really highlight that. One of the ways you do that, I think, involves music, art, and that worship becomes an aesthetic experience. I say becomes. It's been that way for a long time, right? The art world and the church world were married for many years in the Renaissance. I mean, the church was one of the few patrons that could afford good art. So a lot of art for thousands of years was religious in nature because the church was a patron of the arts. And the cathedrals in Europe, you know, the windows and the artwork that adorns them. I mean, worship was meant to be an aesthetic experience, multi-sensory. You think it's radical that we have screens in worship that sometimes have images on them? Worship has always been image-driven, right? With the Reformation and that move north to the head, a lot of us put the screens aside. They've only reappeared in the last couple of decades. But windows, art, and I think Emergence Christianity has a really interesting relationship with modern artist, performance art, installations in worship. There's a local guy, Ted, I can never remember his last name, but he's done some amazing things. I see his pictures on the internet worldwide, and he's here in Des Moines. And he'll do a thing, one very memorable thing he's done, he's taken the, he'll do a map of the world on the floor, and he used the communion breadcrumbs. And so he breaks up these breadcrumbs, and he creates a map out of bread on the world. And it's just, it's really interesting, interactive, tactile things that he's doing as a modern artist, a faith person of faith, to get people to engage in issues of faith. So I see music, art, dance, poetry, all of the expressive arts, visual and otherwise, as being a real integral part of reclaiming these ancient ways. And of course, scripture and how we devote ourselves to the apostles' teachings. I think scripture has a very prominent place, although it might be redefined, because I don't think any Emergence Christians really think of the Bible. We don't read it the way Ken Ham does, like it's a science book. We read it like it's a book of faith, and it may not be factual, but it's true. We know these stories are true, and we live by them. So a devotion to scripture and the disciplines of prayer that bring us close to the stories of our faith. Another piece, I think, is, well, Phyllis Tickle names a lot of different movements in Christianity historically, especially in recent years, as far back as, I want to say, the Catholic Worker Movement. It's probably, would you say that's 100 years old or less than 100 years? Huh? Yeah, less than 100 years old. The Catholic Worker Movement, that was a lay movement that really took Catholic theology and social teaching to the streets and really tried to work with poor people and to change systems from the street, basically. That's a very, again, I'm painting with very broad strokes here. some of you know about Tazay. She names Tazay as a community. It's a lay monastic community in France. And one of the things that it's known for is its worship and its music. And it's a global center where youth go to travel and make a pilgrimage every year. Iona is another similar kind of community in Scotland. It's more Celtic in nature. It also has a rich music liturgical heritage that has been claimed by many Christians around the world as a way to embrace worship. So there's all these kind of these pockets and these movements. what else? She mentions house church, the house church movement, which again has been around for 75 or 100 years. It's probably been around longer since Acts 2, basically. But a lot of people gathering in their homes and breaking bread at home make church. That is their church experience, is house church. Have you guys ever worshipped or visited a house church? I know you have. You have? And you have? Can you tell me about that?
My brother
Oh, okay. Okay. Interesting. How about you? Okay. Yeah, okay. Every Sunday. All right. And you did that for years, right? Yeah. Families gathering in a church home or in churches' homes, yeah. Yeah. One other piece that I think is interesting, and that is what Phyllis Tickle calls neo-monasticism. I kind of put myself in this bracket. I think it describes a lot of what I do with centering prayer, contemplative outreach. I don't live in community with other people. I don't live in a house or in a monastery. But I share this prayer practice, this centering prayer. I have a personal devotion to it daily, and weekly I meet with other people and we do that. And there are 60,000 people in a contemplative outreach network that do that every day. And there probably are 30,000 people who meet in a group once a week, probably worldwide. this movement towards the monastic sort of order of life, whether it's prayer at regular hours during the day, whether it's removing yourself and retreating from the world, or whether it's just a simple devotional practice like centering prayer or the music and songs and prayers of Tezay. But this, what they call neo-monasticism, I think is a real interesting piece. Because about the time that this scripture was written in Acts, there was monasticism already at work in the deserts of Egypt and Palestine and that part of the world where Christianity was already becoming a lifestyle and a monastic one. So it has deep roots too. So I'm just going to read this scripture again to finish. And verse 42 comes obviously before verse 43. Smartest thing I've said all day. But it wasn't in the scripture that Drew read. So I just want to back up to that one. It's kind of a whole thing in one verse. And then the three or four verses after that kind of describe it more in depth. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of bread and the prayers. All came upon everyone because many wonders and signs were being done by the apostles. All who believed were together and had all things in common. They would sell their possessions and goods and distribute the proceeds to all as any had need. Day by day, as they spent much time together in the temple, they broke bread at home and ate their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having the goodwill of all the people. And day by day, the Lord added to their number those who were being saved.